The film crickets are intended for mature audiences. Any guests on the film crickets do not necessarily share the same opinions as the film crickets. It's time for the Film Crickets with Jay Fortier, Chris Martineau, and Melanie Howerton. On this week's episode, it's just Chris and Melanie, and they continue with the theme of October, reviewing a horror film. Chris and Melanie review the 1990 American psychological thriller film, Misery.
Does it stand the test of time? Let's find out. Your Film Crickets are on now.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Film Crickets, the podcast where we talk about films from the 80s and 90s. I am co-host Chris Martineau. I'd like to welcome in other co-host Melanie Howerton. Hello, Melanie.
Hello, Chris.
What's happening?
Not much. We're going to do Misery today. I'm excited.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So Jason does have the afternoon off. He's doing something somewhere with some things. So, I'm actually on my way after this. I'm very excited. I'm going to the Alamo after this to see one of my favorite movies of all time, The Thing, which 1982 on the big screen. Oops. I'm very excited about that. Never actually seen it on the big screen. They've got a bunch of stuff. Sweeney Todd this month. They've got The Exorcist. They have The Shining, that Little Shop of Horrors. So I'm excited to see that, but I got to choose one and I'm choosing The Thing. So, I'm excited.
Awesome.
I can't wait to see the spider head crawling upside down. It's
going
to be fucking great. All right. So anyway, we chose Misery this week. 1990 classic Misery, Rob Reiner film. This is it's weird. Is it a horror movie? It's horrific. There's no supernatural elements to this at all. And it is it's kind of a Stephen King classic. What is your history with Misery? So do you own this on VHS, DVD? Your mother own it, have the Laserdisc? What's the deal?
We've got it on DVD.
My
mother has literally everything Stephen King has ever written or, you know, any movie that has ever been produced, you know, from a book that he wrote.
Yep.
So, of course, we have it. So I was glad to see that I didn't have to rent it. So I feel like I've just always seen this movie. And I remember specifically one time when me and my husband were dating, we had an anniversary. We went to Maine in a bed and breakfast and they had a little thing of DVDs. So I grabbed it and we watched it on our little anniversary.
Oh God, well, that's so romantic.
He had never seen it before.
They have a candlelight dinner in the movie. I mean, it's sort of romantic, I guess.
Yeah.
But you didn't see it in the theater. You've only seen it on video.
I can't remember. It's so long
ago.
Okay.
I saw it in the theater. It was a big deal. I remember everybody was going to see Misery. It got a lot of Oscar buzz. I had this great actor in it, Kathy Bates, and we had James Caan from Godfather, and it was a Rob Reiner film. I always liked Rob Reiner, and he can pretty much direct anything. So I know I saw it in the theater, and then I know I rented it, and it's not like I watched it all the time because it's a tough movie to watch.
Yeah.
It's so tense.
Yeah.
And it sets up just like the book. The book is very tense. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about some of the aspects that where this book is one of the most faithful adaptations from a Stephen King novel ever. I feel as though Rob Reiner captured the essence, the vibe of that book and put it on celluloid and portrayed it to us. And I think King probably said same, that he was very happy with the way that it translated from book to screen. So that's the deal. So Misery is our film. Let's go into the IMDb breakdown. And here we go. We have Misery. Came out in 1990. Rated R. 1 hour and 47 minutes long. The one sentence synopsis is, after a famous author is rescued from a car crash by a fan of his novels, that's saying it lightly, he comes to realize that the care he is receiving is only the beginning of a nightmare of captivity and abuse. As mentioned, directed by Rob Reiner, written by Stephen King and William Goldman, starring the irascible James Caan as Paul Sheldon, Kathy Bates as Annie Wilkes, Richard Farnsworth as Buster, Frances Sternhagen as Virginia, the horniest old couple I've seen on film in quite some time. And so I forgot. They're adorable. And yeah. I forgot. Oh, Jesus. Sorry.
What?
I have these cats that live next door, and they come to say hi, and one just jumped in front of my window.
Oh my God.
Jesus Christ. Hi, how are you? Okay, and sorry. You scared me. All right, now he's leaving. Lauren Bacall's in this movie. I forgot Lauren Bacall. So classy. Yeah. So awesome.
Yep.
She goes way back. So
yeah.
So let's get into Misery. So the word misery is said so many times in this movie.
Yeah.
The book is called Misery. The pig is called Misery. And they say a lot in this movie that they use the word misery in such a weird way. It's the name of the character who is miserable.
Misery, like, Chastain, yeah.
Misery, it's like perfect. Yeah. And Paul Sheldon is like a perfect romance novel name.
Yeah.
To me, it's...
Yeah.
But they'll say it a couple of times. Here's to misery. Let's toast to misery. And to me, that was a weird thing because are they toasting the character or are they toasting their state of mind that they are in misery, right?
Toasting the character, but they are in misery. Yeah.
That's what I mean. Like, and is Kathy Bates... Annie Wilkes, like, she's obviously, well, let's just, how do I put it? She's fucking crazy. So,
yes.
And she's crazy and unhinged. Crazy. Oh my God. And she's crazy in ways that you can't even tell. Right.
Yeah.
But she is in misery while she is, worshiping at the feet of misery. She's you're constantly saying, let's do this for misery. They are like, they're in a constant loop of misery.
Yeah.
And so now I want to talk about so let's establish this thing. Paul Sheldon is the writer of Misery. He doesn't want to write Misery anymore. He's had it. He thinks he's being a hack. He's got better things. He wants to write the Great American Novel, and Misery pays the bills.
Yeah.
Annie Wilkes is the number one fan. She's really unhinged. We come to find out she's a serial killer by the end of the movie, of infants.
Yeah.
Not just, that's classic Stephen King. Like, you take something that you think is bad and you make it like 100 times worse.
Yeah.
I always think of The Tube in Shawshank. It starts as a small tunnel and then it turns into a tunnel of shit. And the tunnel of shit goes 3 football yards, like 3 football fields. It's always making it much, much worse.
Yeah.
So Kathy Bates is obviously nuts and she wants Misery to keep going. So, Melanie, I ask to you, how much of Stephen King is Paul Sheldon?
It's a lot. And I actually have something about that in trivia, what the book is actually really about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I always remember watching this when I was younger, I kept thinking that's probably like his biggest fear is to run into his number one fan. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And to come to find out that this book really is not even about what we would think it would be about. It's actually about the fact that I guess for decades he wouldn't talk about it, but he came out and stated that it was his battle against substance abuse.
Sure.
And that Kathy Bates' character is his dependency on drugs and the hobbling was basically his way of not being able to escape and all that. And he was afraid to kind of tell people because he didn't want it to take away from the movie. But also, I guess in the book, I was reading that Paul Sheldon, the character, was also addicted to drugs. And he got himself clean, but then when Kathy Bates got him captive and was giving him all the Novel or whatever the name was, which is a fake name for codeine or whatever.
Sure.
So she was getting him addicted to drugs again while he was in captivity.
Right.
I don't know. I also know that he loves how Raymer, is it Raymer? How do you say his name?
Who?
The producer.
Reiner.
How he did this. He was like really proud of how he did it. And he was afraid to kind of sell the rights to a movie because he didn't think anybody was going to do it as good. So I have something about that later on too. But I think Paul Sheldon did a really good job with this. I think it's also because he was so freaking frustrated to begin with, like being tied up that long. And like,
yeah, no doubt.
You know?
And I think they cast James. Now, James Caan's kind of was RIP, but not a nice man. Like, he was not a very good person. I mean, and I think they got somebody, even though he's really difficult on a film set, they got somebody who can handle aggravation and anger really well. That's like they got him in Elf to be angry.
Yeah.
You know, and Will Ferrell said, I'm going to pick on this guy until he loses his mind.
Yeah.
And because, but he's poking the bear, but he's doing it on purpose because he wants him to blow up, to actually be angry. And here we have him being angry at Annie. But again, going back to how much.
He can't show it. It's what sucks. It's like he's depending on her for his entire life and well-being. And he can see that she's crazy. I mean, he's even like, from just little things of just having the pig come in and then she's leaving and she's oinking in the room and she's like, you know, oh, I love you and all this. Like, just there's so many things that he's probably thinking, oh, shit. Like, I am dependent on this person for my life and I can tell that she's not all there.
And. But think about this, like, think about the symbolism of this. Maybe Stephen King at this point is, he's done a lot of horror movies. He's got substance abuse problems. Yeah. He wants to do something different. He can't do something different. The fans are like, well, we don't want you to do that. We want you to do the things that we want you to do.
True.
And so totally I'm sure some part of him is just feels trapped by his own success. And again, boo-hoo, you're a friggin' millionaire. Yeah, you're trapped by your success. I wish I had that problem. But the fact of the matter is he wants to do something different. Maybe he can't. And every time he tries to do something, his publisher says, you can't do that. People want this. And after a while, you go, I don't care what the people want. Like, I want to do what I want to do. And so Annie Wilkes is that thing saying, like, if you want to think about it, if you want to stay alive, you must keep churning out these books.
Yeah.
And he fights against it. But the only way he can survive is to keep writing the books, figuratively and literally. If he didn't start writing the redo after he burned his novel,
which I think, oh my God, how horrible. Can you imagine working on something for so long and it's like the only copy that you have and somebody is making you burn it? I mean, it must have been horrible. Like, I can't even imagine.
But on the other side of it, she comes in and says, you must burn this book. And he knows he tries to bluff her.
Yeah.
And she doesn't buy it. And he's like, God damn it. And he lights the book on fire and he's destroyed. And then he goes through a period where I'm sure in writing that book under duress, being forced to write the new book, and he's pulling out all the misery stops.
Yeah.
Right. Everything. And she's all excited about you telling me that back in this other book, there's this connection to the lost father, whatever the fuck it is, like some soap opera thing.
Yeah.
And he writes probably the best book he's ever written and can't wait to light it on fire.
Yeah. He's like, I learned it from you. Why not? I do have to say though, I guess we wouldn't have a movie, but I don't like if, when he sees that she's getting so upset when she, after she's read the book and she's like, you dirty bird, how dare you? Blah, blah, blah. And she's screaming at him. Why wouldn't he just immediately come up with something? And instead of saying, well, lots of people died in childbirth. Duh. Okay. She's obviously unhinged. Why wouldn't you just say, look, let me put you on a little secret. Since you're my number one fan, I just want to let you know she's really not dead. Wait till the next book comes out. You are going to freaking love it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? She's really not dead. And why would I do that? Why would I kill Misery off? She's made me all this money. I love Misery. I'm not going to kill her off. This is just for, you know, to make people go, oh my gosh, you know, like, why wouldn't he spit something else out of his mouth?
That's a good point.
Well, you know what I mean? Like,
I had never thought of that. Maybe probably because it's so well written or so well acted that.
Yeah.
Why don't you lie for a living.
Yes.
Like everything you say is made up. So why not just make up a story? Who knows? Maybe because he's hopped up on drugs or whatever. But he's also making the choice. Now you're saying he's got substance abuse problems, but he is adapting well under the circumstances. Like he should be taking those drugs. He should be taking them, but he knows he makes them goofy. So he hides them and he figures out a way to stuff things in the mattress. So his survival instinct is very, very good. But again, like King, and good for Rob Reiner, because Rob Reiner does what in the movie, what King does in his novels, because we don't know. And I don't know if I texted you this. I was day drinking. But I said, you know, Stephen King has a knack of saying it's bad, but you don't know how bad it is. And when I show you, it's going to be worse.
Yeah.
And we know that Paul's been in an accident and we know he has broken whatevers. But when we finally see his legs for the first time, you're like, oh my God, no, he's not. He doesn't have like a broken leg with a cast. Like they're blue and they're puffy. And it's like, oh God, like how is he not? And then you go, how is he not taking those drugs? How is he not taking the painkillers?
Yeah.
Because he's trying to hatch a plan that keeps getting thwarted. because
I want to say that it was so funny because I remember like when I remember thinking, okay, first of all, he got in the car accident because he's driving on blizzard type conditions, even if it wasn't snowing. But even like my mom goes, well, he said he didn't know. I'm like, who cares if he doesn't know that the snowflakes are actually coming down from the sky? Did you see the freaking roads? The roads, you couldn't see the road before the snow even started. I remember thinking, what a treacherous road that is with all these curves. And the snow is compacted down. Like, there's got to be a foot of snow on the road to begin with. What are you doing driving your 1960-something little tiny little sports car that has no business being on a road like that whatsoever? It's his fault to begin with. And then the whole reason he got into an accident was because his leather briefcase was going to fall on the floor and he reached over to grab it. I'm like, I think the leather little briefcase thing would have been fine if it hit the floor. It's not going to break, you know, let it go and then fix it later on. But oh my God, you know, I just couldn't believe that. I'm like, what is he doing out there on those roads to begin with?
He's not a rocket scientist. He's a writer. He doesn't make good choices. I would say. Right. So he's got issues, you know, Annie's got issues, but we got to talk about Annie here.
I gotta say, Kathy Bates is the best. Oh my God.
She's like 42 in the movie and she dresses like she's 75.
Yeah.
But acts like she's 12.
Yeah.
But sometimes, and that's the thing that's unnerving, I think, about the performance is because she's obviously unhinged.
Yeah.
She is 9 levels of crazy and you don't know when it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Are we gonna get good Annie? Or are we gonna get bad Annie? Annie, and that's him, Paul Sheldon. Whenever he says something, he doesn't know what answer he's gonna get. He doesn't know how she's gonna react to anything he says. Yeah. Even if he you can see him planning in his head. He talks to her like a child. Well, Annie, and very calm, right? Because he doesn't want to upset her, but it doesn't matter. And you don't know what Annie you're gonna get. Are you gonna get petulant child Annie? Are you going to get serial killer Annie?
Yeah.
To me, the most terrifying moment in the movie, it's right near the end and it's raining. And out of nowhere, she just goes, the rain really bums me out.
Oh, I know.
I've got 2 bullets. I think I just go get them. What? Where'd that come from? I'm glad it only rained now.
Yeah. What about when she's walking around the bed trying to get him to burn the book and she's going like this with the gasoline all over, like basically letting him know, like, I can burn you alive in this bed anytime I want to. So do what I say.
and that she knows, she's known that he's been out. So she's like, you know, to quote The Simpsons, stupid like a fox. Like she knows exactly. And then once she reveals the fact that, I know you've been out twice. My penguin always points south.
Yes, I always remember that penguin line, yes.
Can you imagine, like, what's running through Paul's head? Like, oh, my God, she knows everything. Like, everything I've done that it's been prescribed or for a reason to try to get in her good graces, she knows everything.
Yeah.
So is she that...
She has to reach for the knife, and she's, like, looking for this.
Here's the knife. Were you looking for this? Like, it's so perfect, but also on the other side, if Annie is analogous to the fans in Stephen King's career and wanted to do something different, but being forced to do the same thing over and over again because of his popularity, then why wouldn't it make sense that the fans are going to cut me off at every turn? Every time I try something different, they're going to say, this, you know.
I often wondered if she would have let him live. If he didn't kill Misery in there because she wanted another book to come out and she would get him better and then rescue him. I wonder if she would have let him go, but then she was already lying about the roads and the phones being down. So I don't know.
It's hard to say. He makes the book that she thinks. Well, she told him that she loved him.
Yeah.
Like straight up. And like, how do you react to that?
Yeah.
You're pinned down in bed with this crazy person that says, no, I used to love you as an idea. Now I actually love you, Paul.
And then after she does the hobbling, she's like, God, I love you.
I know. But even in the back of his head, does he go, wait a minute, do I take advantage of the fact that she's in love with me?
Yeah.
Like, is this an in? Is this an in for me to get out of here?
And which he kind of did when he had the dinner with her. Remember, he was going to drug her, but then she spills the freaking wine, and he must have been like, oh, my God.
Because,
go ahead.
Go.
I was just thinking, like, when he actually did get to crawl out of his room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he before he crawled, he was in the wheelchair, you know, and he unlocks the door with this little safety pin, which she says, "I found your key," you know, whatever. So he gets out in the wheelchair. The first thing he does when he can barely move and he's in a wheelchair anyway is go to the front door and it's locked and he goes, "Figures," or whatever. And then he's trying to go to the phone, whatever. What does he think he's going to go do at that door? He's in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. The driveway is like 10,000 feet long. There's snow everywhere. He's all broken and he can't even move. What's he going to do? Get himself down 2 feet off the porch and then the wheelchair falls over and he just lays there like a slug and she comes up the driveway? Like, what is his plan at that point?
Hi.
just wanted some fresh air.
I don't know what happened. I was sleeping and now I'm here in the driveway. And she probably go, "Oh, you wackadoodle."
Yeah.
You wackadoodle dancy pants.
I just wanted some fresh air.
So we talked about that. So we got it's a trope that's in Stephen King novels because he's from a small town, a blue collar town in Maine. He loves country bumpkins. Mm-hmm. He loves them. He thinks they're fantastic. And he will always make it look like these little town folk are clueless until they actually have to figure something out. And the sheriff in this movie, and also the sheriff in the book, who is adorable, is this cute old guy. And I love his relationship with his wife, who's also like the deputy. And they're always trading like sex barbs to each other, like, you know, like we're going to get some later. And it's just like, you can't help but think about this older, very older cup, 70s in bed going at it.
She puts her hand on his leg when they're driving. He's like, we're in this vehicle, we're working or whatever. And she's like, this deputy would rather be at home under the covers with a sheriff or something.
Yeah, that's good stuff. But I mean, the fact of the matter is the state police doesn't know what to do with it, but the country bumpkin sheriff has more common sense
knows.
Because they're townies, they know the ins and outs of everything. Mm-hmm. And one of the bad parts about being in a small town is everybody knows everything about everybody. But one of the good things about being in a small town is everybody knows everything about everybody.
Yeah.
And they know that Kathy Bates came down, Annie Wilkes came down, that he remembered what kind of paper she bought. Because how many customers did he get that day? 5?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? And he's able to kind of sleuth it out just from the intel from... And being able to smell when something is fishy. Something just isn't right. Because in this town, everything always happens the same way at the same time. Mm-hmm. So he'll be able to spot an instant when something is weird. Whereas from a city point of view, anything that goes on is not that weird. Because a lot of weird shit happens in a city all the time. But in a small town, you don't. And I appreciate Stephen King never doesn't go far away from that too much. Which I kind of always liked about him.
Well, also, too, he wanted to read the book to get to know Paul Sheldon a little bit better.
Yeah.
And there was a line in there that said something about, like, you know, being judged or something by God or something. Mm-hmm. And he was like, "That sounds familiar. Why does that sound familiar? I've read that line before." So he knew in his head, he remembered that, goes back to the library and sees that it was Kathy Bates, well, Annie, that actually said that during a court trial. Oh, my God, too. I remember when she said, like, she goes, "Sometimes my thinking is a little muddy. That's why I could not remember everything on the witness stand in Denver." He was probably like, "Come again? What?
What?
Like, what?
So what? What happened? What?
What are you saying?"
Agreed. I don't know. It works on a lot of levels. We're gonna get to TMI here in a minute. Just one last thing: the final demise of Kathy Bates. First of all, I don't know that you needed the additional jump scare. I thought that was just a bit much. It's not necessary. It was fun. And he finally got to like get rid of her. She dies on the typewriter. But I mean, how much again is Stephen King saying, "You want this book here," and stuffing, like, "You want this garbage here, take this, shove it down your mouth."
Yes,
like,
I love that.
Some part of his brain must be like, "I have to make these, you know, I keep cranking out these horror books, and now you dumb consumer here, just shove it down your mouth. You want some more, huh? You want some more? Well, here's some more.
Eat it.
Does he?" And I'm sorry, and I might have looked away, again, day drinking, but does he hit her with the typewriter?
He does.
Yeah. He does. Okay. So I wasn't sure if that was... So, like, how symbolic is that?
Yeah.
Like, you gave me this 50-pound thing, and I'm going to beat you to death with it.
Yeah.
And the thing that you want is going to be the thing that is going to eventually end you. So, all right.
Now, I know she stopped working a long time ago as a nurse, a long time ago.
Right.
Why in the hell does she have boxes full of like drugs in her closet? How the hell did she get away with stealing that much? Did you see how much was in there?
She had a lot of drugs, but back in the day, I don't think there was as much tracking in 1990. I will tell you a quick story about my grandmother. I had pneumonia. Uh-huh. And when I was in like the eighth grade, seventh grade, and my parents are going away on vacation, but I was super, super sick. So I stayed with my grandmother. It was around Halloween time.
Yeah.
My grandmother was an RN. And my grandmother, again, rest in peace. She was she could be a pain in the ass to somebody if she wanted something.
Yeah. But
she just wouldn't give up. And which is probably, it's like a rabid St. Bernard, you know, trying to help, but boy, she could be a pain. And she convinced the doctor that she would go to all the time, that was my grandfather's doctor.
Uh-huh.
She convinced the doctor to give her blank prescription pads.
Get out of here.
Because she would say, I'm an RN. I know what to give him anyway.
Oh my God. And they did it.
Now, she didn't abuse any part of it. She was just able to give my grandfather the medication that she needed. But I was home with her, and she wrote me a prescription for penicillin.
That's insane. A doctor can lose his license for that now. That's crazy how you get away with everything.
Not amoxicillin. Straight up penicillin.
Wow.
And I got better because she's like, you need antibiotics. You've got pneumonia. You need penicillin. We're not going to the doctor. Scribble, scribble, scribble. Go to CVS.
Oh my God.
Nuts. Crazy.
That's crazy.
Now, you can't do that. It's a little more. Probably, you know, things are in place now. Can't do that.
Yeah.
But. All right. Let's hit TMI.
Okay.
All right. Well, hopefully, if I can't turn it on, we're just going to have you read. So let's see.
Oh, wait. I was going to say, at the end of the movie, when the waitress comes up to him and she goes, I'm your biggest fan. He's probably thinking, okay, that's good. Now get away from me.
It's time for TMI with Melanie.
Listen to this. I am in the bathroom right before the movie starts.
Uh-huh.
And I'm in the stall and there's no toilet paper.
Yeah.
Mine are at home in a display case above my bed.
TMI, my friends.
TMI? Too much information. Don't go there, but that's lame.
Now, here's Melanie with your timeless movie info.
All right, time for TMI. Hit it, Melanie. What you got for us this week?
Okay, so first I'll just show you a picture in case anybody's looking.
So weird.
And then, that right there was actually a display somewhere. It's somewhere. I don't know where the display is. Okay. So let's see. Budget was $20 million. It grossed $61.3. I thought that was kind of low, honestly, for a movie like this. Didn't you think so?
Sure.
Stephen King was quite impressed with Kathy Bates' performance in the film, so much so that he later wrote two more roles for her, Dolores Claiborne, in 95. He also wrote a script for a TV's miniseries, The Stand, in 94. His original novel featured a male character named Ray Flowers, but upon hearing that Bates wanted to be involved, he rewrote it as a part for a woman, Ray Flowers, so that Bates could play the part. Stephen King was initially hesitant to sell the film, I think I said that, as Misery, because he was very skeptical that Hollywood would actually make a movie faithful to his vision. However, he was so impressed with the adaptation of one of his works, Stand By Me, and agreed to sell Misery under the provision that Rob Reiner would either produce it or direct it.
I forgot he did Stand By Me. I forgot Reiner did Stand By Me. Yep.
Yeah. James Caan once showed up to the set with a hangover, and all of his scenes he shot that day were unusable. Rob Reiner, I guess he didn't want to tell him that, so he told him that we had to do the scenes all over again because there was a problem at the lab. But when Caan learned that it had nothing to do with the labs and it was his fault, he offered to cover the money that the studio lost. One of Stephen King's first typewriters had a malfunctioning N key, just like the one used by Paul Sheldon in the movie.
And in the book, it's N-N-S and something else. Oh my God.
Yep. I didn't write that because it wasn't actually like what his key was. That was kind of cool. Yep. But yeah, I saw that. James Caan and Kathy Bates clashed over their acting methods. Caan believed in as little rehearsal as possible, where Bates, with her theater background, was used to practicing a lot. When she commented to Rob Reiner that Caan was not attempting to relate or even listen to her, Reiner told her to use that frustration towards her character.
Perfect.
James Caan had to stay in bed for 15 weeks of shooting. Caan said he thought that Rob Reiner was playing a sadistic joke on him, knowing that he would not enjoy moving around for so long. Caan found it much tougher to play that kind of a role and was literally miserable for most of the time. It worked in his favor for the role. Kathy Bates had a hard time turning off her character of Annie after filming. Rob Reiner picked up on the fact that she was getting more and more isolated, and as the shooting progressed, he tried to help her leave Annie behind when the workday was done. Despite not getting along at first during the shooting of the movie, James Caan and Kathy Bates actually became really good friends in real life. Bates was heartbroken upon hearing of Caan's passing in 2022 and said that working with him in this movie was one of the best experiences in her career. In 91, Kathy Bates became the first woman to win an Oscar for the best actress in a horror or a thriller film. Yep. Frances Sternhagen, who played the sheriff's, who played the wife of the sheriff, was actually the voice talent for Dolores Claiborne on the audiobook. I thought that was kind of cute. Oh, yeah.
That's neat. Okay. Yeah,
which later starred Kathy Bates in the title role. For the scene where James Caan had to crawl out of bed, the cast and crew were excited for the scene, saying that we literally only moved like 4 feet, but it was the most exciting to be shooting something other than in that bedroom. Mm. Director of photography, Barry Sonnenfeld.
Yes, directed Men in Black.
Okay. He spit on the hardwood floor to indicate where Caan should crawl to. Caan said that was the only movie where somebody hucked a loogie for his marks.
Wow.
During the course of the film, Annie says, "Oh, Paul," 12 times. Annie, Kathy Bates, places a wooden block between Paul's, James Caan's ankles and uses a sledgehammer to hobble him. In the book, Annie cuts off his left foot with an axe and then cauterizes the stump with a propane torch to stop the blood loss.
Jesus Christ. The scene
was changed so that it would not be too much gore.
Yeah.
Kathy Bates ended up actually being very upset over all the violence in the movie. James Caan recalled that his co-star was crying when it came to time to shoot the hobbling scene. And she was also crying towards the end of the fight sequence as well.
Oh.
When Kathy Bates picked up her Oscar and made her speech, one thing that she said joking around was, "I would like to thank Jimmy Caan and apologize for the ankles." And then James Caan said that after doing this movie, he heard maybe about 100,000 times, "How are your legs, Jimmy?"
Nah.
According to director Rob Reiner.
I'm sure
Reiner,
he loved it. I'm sure he loved all that. Yes. Yeah.
According to director Rob Reiner, Annie Wilkes' killing spree is loosely based on that of Jeannie Jones, a nurse who is believed to have killed as many as 60 children who were in her care over a 2-year period.
Ugh.
That's it.
Oh, you're a, you know.
I know.
Special place in hell.
Exactly.
Special place in hell. All right. Yeah. All right, so let's see if it holds up. Final judgment coming your way, and
it's time now for final judgment. Are you ready to rubber stamp this bitch? Here's the final judgment.
All right, so now it's time for final judgment. All opinions are now off the table. They have now become fact. We have to decide whether or not this movie holds up to the stand, holds up to the test of time. I will start, and I will say yes, it does. It is a kind of a modern masterpiece. Mm-hmm. It is as tense as all get out. The acting is absolutely out of control. It doesn't matter that it's in the non-cell phone era, because Stephen King, even if you tried to remake it, you have to put them in an area where there's no cell phone coverage, and there is still those areas in the middle of nowhere. So it is completely plausible that this could happen. So the unbelievability, Melanie, I never thought of those things at the beginning of the movie where Paul could have evaded all of this. So good for you for thinking of that. Never even dawned on me. The snow road, yes, but not the other stuff.
Yeah.
It does. There's no way around it. It's fantastic. And, just from the attention standpoint and an acting standpoint and a directing standpoint. Melanie?
Yeah. I 100% agree. I feel like if this came back out in the movies, or you could show this to anybody in the world if they can handle this hobbling part, you could show that to anybody and there's no way that they wouldn't be completely involved in it. It is very tense. Kathy Bates was phenomenal. Phenomenal. I watched it before. I just have such a great appreciation for her more now, I think, because I just noticed things before that I just kind of just went right over my head. But she's amazing in it. I think they both were. I love the sheriff and I love his wife. I think everybody's amazing. And even if it did have cell phones, it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because she would have had hers on her somewhere, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And then he wouldn't have had his, because it would have been trashed in the car. So nobody would have still been able to find him and he still would have been stuck there. Definitely could happen. Number one fans, who knows what the number one fan could be possible of doing, especially when one is a psychotic serial killer. So I love it. And I also think it definitely holds up.
Super. All right. Well, look at that. We're done. So, hey, that was Misery. So I want to thank everybody again for listening to our show. Please rate, review, subscribe, all that stuff, and get the word out to everybody. Let people know what kind of a product we have here. I'd like to thank Steve Lavoie for the vocal stylings and the intro, and Draco and the Malfoys for the theme song. We missed Jay today, but he'll be back pretty soon. On behalf of myself, Chris Marno, and co-host Melanie Howard tonight, I'd like to thank you all for tuning in. And movies may not age like fine wine, but we drink them anyway.
That's right.
Bye. Film Crickets, chirping about movies.